Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I am Director of Digital Services at Eastwick Communications, and every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. Today is Friday, July 31st, and on this lovely Bay Area day, or at least I'm in the Bay Area, I have the pleasure of speaking with two guests, Jennifer Palka and Brady Forrest, who are the co-chairs of Web 2.0 Expos, among many other accomplishments. Brady and Jennifer, are you there?
I'm here. This is Jen.
Hi, Jen. And let's see, Brady, I know, was on the line. And he is, let me just take him off hold. Brady?
Yep, I'm here calling in from Seattle.
Yay. So tell me, where are you, Jennifer? Are you in the Bay Area right now?
Yes, I'm working from home today in Oakland.
Oh, great. We're both in the East Bay. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Go East Bay. And Seattle, you know, love the rain. So gotta love Seattle,
hey,
right?
We had record heat this week.
So what has it been, like 70?
104.
Really? Seriously? 104?
Yeah. The,
oh,
the
my
rain God. Thing is a myth. We say so we don't get Bay Area traffic.
Yeah, I have to say, my mom and I did before I joined the Peace Corps, I was like, I got to see the Pacific Northwest, like the whole thing, because born and raised in California, I need to see everything before I go and try to say that I've seen Central Asia. So, so we drove all the way up to Vancouver, but we, of course, spent time in Seattle along the way, and I loved it, and we hit a heat wave, and it was like in the 70s. So that's amazing, 104, I can't even believe it.
And so that down here to the Bay Area. We need some summer.
Yeah, that's what people were asking me for earlier today.
Yeah, and maybe you can ignite that. But we'll get to all that stuff. Thank you both for joining. I really appreciate you both coming because I think you have such amazing backgrounds individually. And I see you every year at Web 2.0 Expo. And, you know, you're sort of like you're tag teaming. And I have to say, I always feel like you've got to be the most beleaguered too of the group because everybody must seize you with every potential question or concern, and you've got to deal with everything that can go wrong at the last minute. First of all, you know, you guys are both obviously in conference planning and execution right now, but have these, you know, content backgrounds. What got you into the firing line, in a sense, of conference work, you know, promoting, doing content, being the face of these conferences that you are such champions of?
Do you want to go first, Brady?
Sure. Well, I mean, I have a pretty varied history. I started out doing supply chain management, systems integration work. And then
I missed that in your bio.
What's that?
I missed that in your bio, but I did get the Burning Man thing.
Yep. Well, Burning Man came right around the same time that I switched to my first startup, and we got bought by Microsoft, and I was a PM there for about 6 years. And along the way, I took an interest in helping to make search, live search, now the Bing team, more accessible and try to, you know, bring in outside influencers and started running programs like that internally and got to know O'Reilly through it and approached them about becoming a conference chair. And that was 3 years ago.
Jen?
Yeah, I think there's something about the sort of a profile of person who likes to do both technology and conferences. Technology usually because there's just an interest in what's new, but also what can sort of make the world a better place, what can we do with all this stuff, and then conferences because, you know, it attracts people who want to be connectors, and I know Brady's one of those people. I've been doing conferences for far too long, longer than I would really like to say, and I initially did conferences for the video game industry. I ran, if some people may know, the Game Developers Conference. I ran that from 95 until I took a break in 2003, and that was just a really exciting time to be in video games because it was sort of just when they were coming into their own. There was a vibrant community of people interested not just in sort of making them technically better, but in and understanding what they could be as an art form, and maybe someday will be. So that was really fun for me, and then I was, I think I've just been blessed to fall into sort of the right place at the right time, because to start working on the WebTube brands in 2005 just also, again, meant being somewhere where there was just an enormous amount of potential and energy and connections to be made, and I really thrive when I'm helping make that happen. So you mentioned sort of a lot of people coming up to you at shows and wanting help with things from the very mundane to the very big, and it can be overwhelming, but I think if for people like me and Brady, that's what we really like to do, so it's just extremely satisfying.
Great. So what were your obviously Web 2.0 this year was, the power of less being the message. I attended, so obviously I can speak more to that conference, but we will get to the other conferences that you work on. But I wanted to ask you specifically around the content and sort of the structure and message, because a lot of the reason I go to these conferences, and I think a lot of my colleagues in the social media world do, is obviously the keynotes. We're always looking to see what's so and so going to say. And the keynotes this year were a little different. And, of course, the message was different. I mean, my first reaction, I have to put my hand up and admit, I was sort of like, duh. we all have to figure out the power of less, which, kind of felt like long hours at that point, but lucky to be employed at the same time. But looking at it at a higher level through the keynotes was kind of a nice way to sort of look at it. How much input do you guys get into, kind of the themes and certainly the keynotes? I mean, obviously Tim O'Reilly is considered sort of a force of nature. I don't know what it's like to work with him, but tell me about that process.
Well, the theme really is our job as a conference chair, and that's a theme that we started talking about quite a while ago. Our passion really is not just what's going on, but how can this be applied in ways that can really have an impact? And it was at our New York event, we started our first Web 2.0 Expo New York, September last year. And I don't remember the exact date, it's probably the 15th. If you look back in the calendar for that day, that's when the exact day the stock market had its first really major crash. And the financial institutions were going under. And it really felt like, here we were on site, having a wonderfully successful event that we were thrilled with, and working at the same time on our theme for our 2009 shows. And we'd actually already done a whole campaign and a whole visual look and feel around a totally different concept. And we sat there and looked around at the show at all the people really panicking and really feeling like this is something major that's happening that we need to pay attention to. And we realized that where we really fit in as people who've been sort of, beating the drum of Web 2.0 for the past 5 years, is that this is the solution to these problems. With stock market crash and the feeling that Web 2.0 was somehow involved with it, there was a little bit of a mixed message where people were concerned that there'd been a bubble and that, once this, we were repeating the late 90s, but it's really the opposite. It's that the financial institutions had a real obvious bubble. The real estate market had a bubble. And rather than being the cause of the problem, we were very clear that the ideas and principles of Web 2.0 could solve this problem or help solve the problem by cutting out things, making things more transparent, by cutting out bureaucracy, by being able to do more with less. And so it's probably, I think, one of our more important themes that we've had in the past couple of years, and something that we feel pretty strongly about.
Brady?
And
basically celebrating the fact that it wasn't our fault this time.
this time? Was there a time it was your fault?
Well, us meaning the technology industry,
Yeah, no, I'm kidding you. I get it. But your take on the theme and how it kind of comes together, even between the two of you, how you collaborate.
But it also is just looking at what are people who are in this industry going to need, and it was a much. You want something that people can sink their teeth into, and start to think about and recognize that that's something that they need in their business, but also, you know, in this case, and probably in their personal lives, as they have to look at how to cut back and be prepared for any sort of dark days that come ahead.
So,
and the power of less really
does
apply, like, to a lot of the technologies coming out right now.
Jennifer, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I think one of the sort of pieces of our mission in this, too, is to help people see it not just as, okay, people are getting laid off, more has to be done with less, longer hours, things like that, but just as a sort of freeing force, in that we now have the excuse to, if I'm allowed to say this, sort of get rid of the bullshit in our lives. We have
mm-hmm.
we have the justification now to streamline things and to find a new and better way of doing things that we may not have had when everything's going well, when money is flowing, when there's money to fund the sort of bigger, clunkier projects. And we've heard that from people over and over again since we put this theme out there, that in some ways having less makes it possible for you to do more, to be more effective, to have more control, or in some ways to let go of control in a way that can be really freeing, and actually have a better outcome. It's not just about sort of working harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that, you know, as I said, the keynotes were a little bit different, and I noticed that you chose speakers that maybe were a little less obvious than I would have thought, at least this year. So, for example, there was someone who I think was from the University of Rochester. A design person was on the panel.
John Maida.
Yeah.
Yes. So what goes into, first of all, you know, picking the keynote speakers? And then in this case, certainly people around me and myself, we were, you know, chatting about the choice to bring him. He certainly had interesting insights. It was coming from a different place than you usually come to expect. And maybe we shouldn't expect anything, but, he was definitely coming from a different place, and I thought it was an interesting choice. So who is at the keynote get decided?
Well, I can
well,
speak
it's
to
a
that
combination.
One a little bit.
Well,
sorry, Trey, go ahead.
Talk about John.
Pardon?
You should talk about John. You brought him in.
Yeah, sorry. I'll speak briefly to that and a little bit to the process, and then maybe Brady can talk more about some of the other keynotes. Yeah, as you said, Brady and I are very close collaborators on the program, that we do sort of, we each bring people to the table that we think will fit the theme or illustrate a point that needs to be made. And John Maida, who is the guy you're referring to, is known in design circles as being sort of a guru of simplicity. And that is not, you know, the sum total, but certainly a big aspect of the power of less is just how to keep it simple, how to get back to a simpler process, a simpler design. That's very timely now because of, obviously, the environment of less resources, but is in some ways for the Web 2.0 world kind of old news. If you remember sort of, back to, say, 2003, 2004, website, you know, the more popular websites were still sort of these big cluttered portals, and you had these new hotshot, you know, kids on the block come on with sites like Flickr or even Google that sort of been around more. It still was disruptive because of its simplicity, and that's been a hallmark of Web 2 all along. So what we were trying to do is to get somebody like John up there on stage to get you thinking about the power of a simple design, a simple interface, a simple idea, and how you can take that and play with it. We just really want to sort of highlight the idea and have different people take different takes on the theme because our audience is so diverse. We can't assume that someone sitting in the audience is a developer or a designer or a business person or runs a nonprofit or, you know, is doing a startup, whoever. We have a really broad audience, and so what we feel, instead of saying, here is specifically one technology you could use, or here's a, you know, design strategy. For our keynotes, we just really want to get people thinking about ideas that we think that they could take on their own and apply.
And John, of course, is known, too, in the open source community as well, which, you know, is an area that I know we have a couple of open source clients that have seen a lot of interest and growth too. So it made a lot of sense from that perspective as well. Brady, I know you wanted to jump in as well.
Well, there's also just a more pragmatic view that I take towards the keynotes and to the conference in general, programming the conference in general, which is, you know, on the keynote day, you want a big name. You want someone who's going to deliver inspiration, which is what John fulfilled. You want
mm-hmm.
some people who are current practitioners who are delivering something now, so there's some sort of news excitement. And then perhaps somebody who's been doing research or some combination of the three. And so you try and piece it out so that you lead in with the big name and you end with someone who's inspirational. So you get
mm-hmm.
people in the door and then you leave them with lofty thoughts. And in between, you try and put in shorter messages that really bring home the punch, news, or some piece of research.
So one of the things I thought was really interesting, and again, I'm sticking to this conference because I was at it, and I do promise we will broaden, but I have to ask you about Tim O'Reilly's interview with Stephen Ellop from Microsoft. How did that come about, and what did you think of it, if I can ask you just your frank opinion?
I'll let Brady start.
Tim and Stephen, Tim and Stephen were on the Macromedia board together.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've known each other for years and been friends. So it was through that connection and the fact that Stephen's taken over, you know, information workers for Microsoft, how we ended up getting Stephen. And
mm-hmm.
I thought the interview was interesting. It definitely, you know, Microsoft has a tough road to walk in these spaces, and Office in particular has not been fast moving, and I think that's one of the reasons why Stephen was brought in. He hasn't been there that long, so it's going to take him a little while longer to affect the change that I think a lot of people really want to see and are expecting to see happen.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. So did the interview, what were you going to ask?
Well, I just wanted to get Jen's thoughts as well, and I'll give you what my thought was.
I mean, I think that, you know, I'll say right up front, you know, our jobs is to look at the ratings that come back from all these things, and we do look at them, and that talk didn't get the best ratings, and I don't think it's necessarily Stephen's fault. I mean, I think he's going up there. I think, you know, his probably goal was to come off as a reasonable and intelligent and friendly guy, and the bar that he has to hit, I think, to be successful in front of that crowd is a little different than the bar that somebody like Vic Gundotra, who did it the next day, has to hit. And you have to sort of judge him by those. I also think, though, that as programmers of conferences, we need to look at the ratings and make sure that we're understanding the impact of any speaker on our audience. But also realize that we need to balance the event. We need to provide something for everybody. We need to have people leave with an accurate picture of sort of where our industry stands, and that sometimes that means that, you know, we're going to have talks that don't rate quite as well, but that serve an important purpose, and that, you know, and we never know how things are going to go. So I think he did a good job given the task at hand, which was really not easy.
Yeah, and I mean, we have to say that people, you know, were actually hissing at him, you know, various negative things on the way up to speak, and that's never a good, probably, way to preface things. I sort of, you know, my takeaway was that there seemed to be an uneasiness that I've never seen on Tim's part, and I don't know if that was because I actually then looked into, okay, what's the connection between these guys, right, to see if they even knew each other, because I couldn't tell from the interview. So I got, you know, I'm very interested in behavioral dynamics from, you know, all this web stuff, right, you know, generational information and behavioral information. And so that was part of, I think, the dynamic, too. And when you talk about the ratings, what Jen is talking about, for those that don't know, is that when you go to these conferences, they do this great and in a nicely aggressive way, they continue to remind you to either go online, and I think you can even do it on paper if you want to rate the session. So it's for the folks that are spending the money to go to these conferences to actually rate the sessions, and which is so valuable because you know, there's some guys that just knock it out of the park, and you want to really be able to, you know, scream from the rooftops, bring him back next year, and then other people that talk about their company and don't listen or want any questions, and you just want them to kind of go away or at least get the feedback that it's supposed to be a two-way dialogue, especially when it's in person. So that was sort of my takeaway, and I don't know if anybody else had this sort of kind of feeling of it seemed uneasy for the two of them for different reasons. And that's what I ended up focusing on the most. So maybe I had like a completely different take than other people, but I thought it was really interesting. I thought it was interesting that he talked, there were a few things that he talked about. So, you know, 2 years ago it was tell me having something new, Microsoft having an announcement at the beginning. I just remember new. This year was, you know, to your point, Jen, about streamlining, completely about we have to streamline, you know, from a you know, functional business point of view. We can do so in our professional lives. It can make things better. It can inspire innovation. And those are all things that, you know, are great for all of us to look at in our personal lives, to Brady's point earlier. So I think that was, you know, a really nice part of the way the keynotes turned out at the conference. I think you guys did a great job, but I think you had probably a tougher audience this year, too, because of the economy, don't you think?
I think we did. And if I mean, I think what you're pointing to in terms of, like you said, lack of ease, you know, we have ELAP up there not just to sort of give us what's going on with Microsoft, but because when you talk about streamlining and, you know, bringing things down, I mean, that is the challenge that they have. And you could look at his performance up there as not just an industry keynote, but as, you know, he's struggling with the same challenges the rest of us are. Now, if you're a startup, you're in a great position. If you're doing this in a really large enterprise, a lot of the sort of things that are easy that you can, principles that you can hold on to, you know, new technologies that you can employ, great. But you find yourself in these positions where you may be very open to the idea of power of less or the a new technology or a way of streamlining things, and there's a lot of legacy systems and a lot of legacy culture in place, and he's in that position. So I think some of the audience were hissing at him. I think others in the audience were saying, this guy has a really hard job.
Yeah. I mean, when you listen to the, you know, the things that he's in charge of, it was everything from their internet telephony / unified communications play to potentially a free version of Microsoft Office that has ads in it, you know, that it sounds like it's completely at a talking stage. It's not even at a, from a product point of view, it doesn't even sound like it's entered really a formal product, or at that point, it didn't sound like it was too much of a product realm. It was more of a business concept that they knew that they needed, you know, that it sounded like Microsoft had made some decision internally, and Tim was asking a little bit about that, and Stephen didn't really have a lot of detail to give yet, but, you know, I think to your point, you know, clearly there's things that an organization like Microsoft knows it needs to do quickly, and it's sometimes really hard in a large organization.
Yeah, and I mean, if you don't mind me sort of taking it on and to another product that we're working on, you know, as I said, it's that much harder if you're in a large enterprise and there's a lot more at stake and there's a lot of legacy systems in place. The other place where this sort of power of less concept is playing out for me is in our Gov2O brand that we started since that show. Think about how hard it is to do that inside of government. It's even doubly hard. And these are the harder questions. It's one of the things we've tried to do throughout the time that the Web2 brand's been around is celebrate the cool new ways that people are doing things. And we have to walk a line between celebrating them and recognizing that it's just a lot harder in different circumstances, and yet the payoff is there. So how do we tackle the bigger, harder problems across enterprise and across government?
Absolutely. And I thought one of the things that ties to that is one of my favorite, not necessarily in a good way, but favorite in terms of kind of opening my eyes, Wired article this year was on, you know, the Obama administration trying to kind of, you know, go in with this concept that they had run this really successful online-based campaign and a lot of what, or not necessarily just online-based, obviously, but, you know, the online portion was very successful. And all of the stumbling blocks to the websites that couldn't be touched or couldn't be changed. And so you see that these there's MoveOn, I think this week, had this campaign of, you know, I'll donate a dollar every day until health care reform is passed, for example. And you start to see, and in the context of that article, that the play out of, you know, government really not, you know, someone as powerful as the president not being able to kind of streamline websites and, you know, the sort of chain of command there, and then thinking of the smaller ways it must play out for city, county, other smaller government systems.
There was a talk at Web2 Expo San Francisco by a guy named Andrew McLaughlin, who has been the chief policy advisor at Google, chief policy officer, and is now the deputy CTO of the U.S. under Anish Chopra. He, at the time, was still speaking in his wearing his Google hat, and he talked about how easy it is to underestimate the size of these problems. You know, we're in a company, you can just go open a Google Doc and start collaborating. It's just there are so many things in the way, and it's not just policies, it's real laws that are on the books, especially at the federal level, that keep Obama's administration and other people in all sorts of agencies from doing what seems simple to us. And that's part of what we're dealing with. But if you think about the scale of the federal government there, and if you can take out even, you know, 1 or 2% of sort of, you know, wasted energy and wasted time there and sort of Web 2.0-ify it, the returns are just enormous.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's been boggling my mind as I've learned more about Gov2.0 is just how kind of backwards the technology they're currently using is. Like the fact that a lot of government websites are just HTML pages that have to get hand-tweaked whenever they want to make a change. It's not like they're updating a database. They're actually going into the HTML and modifying those pages.
God, when you think about the nightmare of not even having any data portability options, it's just enormous. So that sort of, you know, brings me to the question of kind of popping up a level and, you know, telling folks how the Government 2.0 event specifically came about and how long it's been around, because people may not, at least for this audience, may not be as well known as, say, the Web 2.0 expos or some of the ones Brady, I'll be asking about, where and emerging.
Yes, the Web 2.0 stuff, the Gov2.0 stuff is our newest brand, also a joint venture between O'Reilly and TechWeb, for whom I work. It came about because I would have to say a lot of people in our team, Tim O'Reilly among them, of course, just became very interested in this space in the lead up to the election last year. My understanding is that Tim was involved. He told me about some of these things, but I think some of them were somewhat confidential, but was involved in a lot of discussions pre-election about what the CTO and CIO roles should look like since Obama had promised to have this new CTO job, and there wasn't a lot of precedent for it. There were questions about who it should report to, what specific responsibilities and authorities should it have. And so that just got him thinking about the potential here and the stakes, how high the stakes really were. If this gets done, if this job gets done right and actually has the authority to make change, how giant an impact it could have, and, of course, conversely, if it doesn't go well, what a lost opportunity.
Right.
So he became very interested in this space, and he had actually been talking to my boss at the time about doing a lot of Gov2.0-type content at Web2.0 and having Brady and I program a lot of that in, which we have. He's been doing a Gov2.0 track at our past events, and there's one planned for our fall New York event as well. But then I think my boss, Eric Furrow, said at the time, let's just do a separate event. And I think that, you know, once those words were out there, it was a foregone conclusion at that point. Everybody really wanted to make it happen. It's not easy. it's a new world for us. We're learning. We're having to be humble and understand that while we do get Web 2.0, it takes a lot to understand how the government works and understand the obstacles that they have and the, I mean, I'm not just talking about the obstacles to adopting Web 2, but like the obstacles to getting people to conferences and things, ethics rules that we didn't understand. It's been a really intense learning curve for us, but a really rewarding and fun one.
And probably really great for the folks that you are working with on the project to learn these things too, so that, you know, as it comes, you know, back to TechWeb, to O'Reilly, you actually collect that knowledge and are able to be more helpful, you know, moving forward for
exactly.
these roles, if the CTO role hopefully continues in government past an Obama administration. What does that look like? What does that mean? How involved can, you know, the Silicon Valley as the scene leader play in that role and what it should be and how it can help?
Well, I mean, I hope that we convene a community around this that, you know, is knowledgeable about both sides of the equation and continues to sort of serve as advocates for it, and that, you know, we can help cultivate that. We're certainly not able to do any of that on our own. But it has been wonderful as a team to learn about this stuff.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is, obviously, I work with pro bono clients and nonprofit clients, and one client in particular who are advocates for children in the foster care or social services system, they're so involved in government issues. It's like, it's astounding to me. And I would think that Government 2.0 is probably, if I looked at the tracks for it, which I haven't done, but I'm aware of what they are for Web 2.0, for example, there's a lot that would probably be relevant to them. So one of the questions I have for you about, you know, creating a new conference is, how did you identify beyond, you know, kind of the genesis of the project, how did you identify kind of the subgroups that you might target to make aware of this event and how it could be helpful, and then, of course, pricing to those needs?
Right. So for the Gov2 brand, our strategy really mirrors the strategy and structure for Web2 in that we have a Gov2O summit that will happen September 9th and 10th this year, and that is, it's still relatively, I mean, I think by Silicon Valley standards, it's quite a modest price. But we're adjusting things, obviously, for that market. But it's the biggest picture of this. It's taking the view of what Web 2.0 can do in government from a real leadership perspective, thought leadership, getting it, as always typical, I think, of these events, we do want to get really specific in some examples because you have to flesh it out. You have to create a picture. You have to start talking about some successes in a way that's concrete enough for people to feel confident in them. But it is looking at the top levels of what can happen across government. It's going to be in D.C., so it's targeted at particularly at the federal government, but it's not limited to that. We've got people coming already from all over the world. We've got people from city, state, local, tribal, municipal governments. To sort of frame it around the federal government is to say this is a moment in time when our leader in D.C., the leader of our country, is saying this is important, and that is an effective framing for us. But the kinds of solutions that we're talking about at the event, really, those principles work at every level, and I think potentially in every culture and every country, which is transparency, collaboration, participation. That's what Obama laid out, and that's the roadmap that we're trying to follow. We're, you know, thrilled with that framing of it because those are three things that we think are so critical to Web 2, that, you know, we have had the playground of the consumer internet and the business space for the past, what is it, you know, 6, 7, 8 years to grow these ideas in that space. We've had a chance to understand what works and what doesn't work in that space. Can't we please take those learnings and apply them to this to government at whatever level? So anyway, to more concretely answer your question, there are a lot of DC people coming to this event, but it is a much broader community than just that.
I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the buzz is while it's happening. Obviously watching Twitter and, you know, looking for the hashtag to see what people are saying on the ground, because I think it affects so many of us. Brady, I don't want to leave you out. Did you, you know, I know you, I don't think you work on Gov 2.0. Is that right? Or do you?
No, I'm not. In fact, I'm looking forward to going so I can immerse myself in it.
Cool.
And learn this space.
Well, let's talk about what you do work on, because we just kind of talked about sort of a heavy area that I think we all intrinsically, whether we know it or not, have a stake in hopefully seeing success from, because, you know, we all want government we can interact with, dare I say it. But talk to me about the couple of conferences, like WHERE 2.0. You know, what is WHERE? If I can say that, with a straight face, and tell us about, you know, for the audience that doesn't know what it is and why it exists, you know, kind of the primer on WHERE 2.0.
Well, you know, WHERE 2.0 actually has a big intersection with Gov 2.0, which I'll get to in a minute. But WHERE 2.0 is a conference where we look at the intersection of the internet and mapping, and over time that's come to mean geolocation. So 5 years ago, Google Earth was launched, and Virtual Earth, Microsoft's mapping product, were both launched at WHERE 2.0, coming right on the heels of the launch of Google Maps. And really what that did was it made maps and geodata available to pretty much anyone with a browser. And you had hackers like Adrian Halavati and Paul Rademacher make mashups like Chicago Crime and housing maps, which really showed people what free geodata or readily available geodata could do. And 2 years ago, you had the iPhone release come out that had Skyhook integration that let people get their location on the phone, make that location available to applications on the phone, and really make their location a part of the picture. And in that 2 years, suddenly you've got pretty much every major browser, i.e. Safari, Chrome, Firefox, both on the desktop and on mobile phones, grabbing users' locations. And so the space is booming right now.
And it's getting easier
on WHERE 2.0. What's that?
And I was just going to say it's getting easier on Blackberries and other devices as well, for those of us that haven't made the leap to the iPhone, for mostly because of Mac / enterprise server compatibility issues. But, I mean, you know, for example, I mean, there's huge surge in the number of sites that do geolocation. Like, I'm a big fan of Doppler and Brightkite. And even you know, Google's Latitude.
Google's homepage.
Google's homepage. I mean, it's just sort of everywhere. How much does, you know, now that there's sort of been this explosion of accessibility to products and more devices being supported, What are you seeing as you know, as new trends in terms of topics for the conference? How has that changed? Because I mean, it just exploded.
Well, probably the biggest change is the ability to get the user's location, and what do you do with that data? How do you protect the user from themselves? How do you protect the user from their future self? You know, if I sign up to always have my location reported, and then I go was shopping for a birthday present, then that gives it away.
Right.
You know, but then there's going to be divorces caused by this. There's going to be, you know, friendship
The minute I bring it up with high-level executives, that's the first thing they do is they say, oh, I can track my wife. It's the weirdest thing. Yet when I think about my mom happens to be a social worker, and as I was saying, I'm working right now. One of my passion projects is actually working for a nonprofit that protects kids, and talking with my mom about somebody she's mentoring. And on her Facebook page, she will often say what her location is, or she uses devices that, you know, she has things devices installed that tell her location. And she goes out to these site visits for reunifying families in you know, danger. So, I mean, literally my mom and her people in her unit, their license plate numbers are protected from even a policeman that pulls them over. They have to do an extra data check to be able to get their ID information. And my license plate is protected in case I'm driving my mom around or whatever. So, I mean, there's this high level of protection, yet you as the user can, you know, for example, with the person my mom mentors at work, you know, her daughter's quinceañera is like on the same page, you know, that information is available in the same place online as her actual geolocation. So, you know, I give a lot of advice to my mom. I'm like, you know, make sure that, you know, everyone in your unit is doing this. And, of course, I'm able to do that more strategically for this organization that I'm working with, helping them hopefully figure out how to, you know, how these technologies people are integrating automatically can be both a wonderful thing, but also can be a danger. But beyond that, what are some of the topics, you know, that you're looking at as really bleeding edge in this area?
Well, the other big thing is user-contributed data. So you've heard of OpenStreetMap?
Oh, of course.
Pretty much an entirely volunteer-created mapping site.
Mm-hmm.
That they are getting funding now, and companies like Google and TomTom are now taking that to heart and have their own products that, if not compete with them, at least are modeled after the OpenStreetMap process. So people are now getting more control over geodata. The other thing is adding time. You know, right now, a lot of maps you see are just flat maps that show points as they exist right now without time as a consideration. But as we get all this real-time data, say tweets coming in or skyhook lookups or, you know, buildings, cities growing over time, it becomes more important to add in time as a factor and let the user control, like, how did things change in Seattle from 1960 to 1990, so it gives you a good feel for how the neighborhoods developed.
Mm-hmm.
Or My Society has done a lot of commuting maps.
Yeah.
That lets people figure out how long will it take someone to get into the center of London if they're looking for a place to live.
Right. Or, yeah, 238 will always be bad in the Bay Area. So we until that is just blown up and started over, and please no one blow it up. But actually, you know what I mean? Certain areas where you just feel like it's never going to get better. But, yeah, it would be wonderful to see what it was like. Must have been much worse before it ever existed. But that's fascinating. I think one of the things, you know, I noticed on your and Brady is, it, for those that don't know, a contributor to O'Reilly Radar. Jen, do you contribute to something on TechWeb that we can talk about?
I write on the Web2 Expo blog, and I very occasionally contribute to Radar.
Yeah, so I've linked. I just spent a bunch of time linking on blogs.eastwick.com to all the different things that they've done in their bios. But one of the things I noticed, Brady, just in the context of this piece of our talk, is of course Doppler has this great carbon footprint that it'll give you if you are entering your or sending information about where you're heading, that you can actually generate a report from. And some executives that we work with just think that's the coolest thing, because they think, you know, there's some way, you know, obviously to leverage that for good or to leverage it for bad or just to leverage it for, you know, I actually care about the earth and this is what I do or don't want to do in terms of making sure I'm contributing positively to travel or what travel, you know, constitutes in terms of the environment.
Well, I think that's an important part of location, is it gives you this opportunity to look back at your life and make it better. So over time,
yeah,
you realize, you know, you could have route optimized, you could have taken public transportation in this case, and
mm-hmm.
you realize how much you walked, how much exercise you're giving up. So I think analysis is another thing that's going to be coming to the location space. You're not just going to have those points on a map, but you'll have products based on Google Maps, most likely, that inform you about your neighborhood and let you make better decisions based on location data.
Very
cool. Doppler is a great tool for that.
Yeah, and Doppler is actually one of the people that created it is a big big in the movement about whether sign-in is really a barrier to conversion or adoption of a site that could have great technology, and whether it really protects the user too, which is a whole other set of questions. But I just remember a couple of years ago when Doppler was a little newer to the scene, sitting in a room and talking about the geeky stuff that I love, user interface and design, and people talking about what is the biggest thing that will impede people from adopting new technologies, new sites, and it was that whole idea of sign-in. And I think we're seeing that universal sign-in or play out in different ways. OpenID, of course, still has yet to really, I think, see the promise, but the sign-in with Facebook, sign-in with Twitter, we're seeing more and more of, and is kind of a different topic, but it leads me to asking you about the emerging technology conference or conferences that have taken place. Are those still active conferences?
Well, we had eTech this past year, and I think right now it's on hiatus. It did pretty well critically, but in the current economy, we're not sure that we're going to do it next year.
Yeah, well, I mean, and certainly it could come back. I mean, I think there's going to be emerging technology every year. It's a nice umbrella term to have under your belt. And how about Enterprise 2.0? That took place this year.
Yeah, that's a tech web event. And we're actually, that event's doing really well. We've launched a second one. I think it's been 4 years that we've been doing it in Boston. And in fact, that's the event that I came to tech web to work on. Web 2.0 became rather a big project, as you can imagine. So
yeah,
wonderful. Steve Wiley and our team runs that event now. We had a successful, very successful event in June, and then we're doing it again this fall in San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping to be able to attend because, obviously, working on a lot of enterprise and with a lot of B2B plays, technology and enterprise, I get asked more and more by reporters about, what is the real promise or when are we going to see the promise of B2B play out in various ways or in the enterprise. In various ways. And, I think that's a fantastic conference. We don't have a ton of time to go into detail. I want to ask you guys about a couple of other things, that obviously, one thing I have to ask about because it was actually the kickoff, official cocktail evening or whatever it's officially called for Web 2.0 this year, but the various Ignites that happen all over at least the state, probably all over anywhere that you have conferences, there could potentially be an Ignite. And Brady, I know you run them, right? And maybe you can explain what they are.
Well, Ignite was started in 2006 here in Seattle. I started with Bree Pettis, who's now working on a 3D printer. And it was just, for me, it was a way to practice being a conference chair. And from there, it's spread on its own.
So you got to let users know or our listeners know what it is, because it is really an experience to go to an Ignite. They're very different than I think they're kind of hard to explain. But I think you live and breathe it. So if you could explain, that would be awesome.
It's an opportunity to bring the community together and let people share their ideas in a very quick and digestible format, hopefully in a way that nobody will get bored. So we limit each speaker to just 5 minutes. They get 20 slides, 15 seconds a slide, and that keeps the audience on their toes. It adds a lot of adrenaline to the talks, and we usually end up with a packed house. So in the last one in Seattle, our sixth, we had about 700 people, or 600 people there.
That's awesome. I think they're such fantastic events. How do you think the crowd has changed? Because I noticed I've gone to, Ignites before in different places, and it seemed like the Web 2.0 crowd was kind of a hard crowd to please, don't you think?
Well, at the Web 2.01, we had the event at the mezzanine in San Francisco, and we had about 800 people at that. There was no seating. So when you don't have seating, it's difficult for people to just, they don't enjoy listening to talks as much. So they'll end up talking. I think people enjoyed the show, but they weren't able to give it their full attention because you're on your feet and you get kind of listless.
We just
in Seattle, you know, we had a longer show, but we had amphitheater seating. So everyone was sitting, and if they wanted to talk, they could go in another room. But
and
over
that's
time,
for the New York one that we did as well. Brady and Tikva Mavarotti hosted one in New York in connection with Internet Week, and it was so fabulous. I have to say, Jennifer, I really agree with you. They're just they're especially when they work really well, and you can give it your full attention. I just find them also to be so rewarding. Both they're entertaining and informative at the same time. I mean, I laughed so hard. That one we had in New York, there were about four presentations I thought were like the best comedy I've seen in forever, and they were based on real interesting information.
Yeah, Bert Sunday talking about his experience being the swine flu on Twitter was pretty awesome.
a guy who had sucked down the data from dating sites across the United States and analyzed it. It was so good.
Yeah, Luc Dubois did a great job with that one.
I really think, Brady, there needs to – I would make the suggestion to you to encourage people to – like Social Media Club I'm really active in – to, like, take up doing some Ignites because we need to have more Ignites in San Francisco for sure. And I'm seeing L.A. here on your calendar. And, of course, being a Bay Area girl, I'm just like we've got to dominate a little bit more. But, yeah, I mean, offering up my help and connections to make some more Ignites happen here because – I think, like Jen said, they're so funny, and yet they're so informative. I mean, you actually get these great nuggets. People have to, again, it's sort of like the power of less in its extreme because people, of course, get performance anxiety and have their own issues about presenting or whatever. But you have to synthesize and think really hard about what you want to get across. And the other thing was I happened to be standing next to somebody, a fellow social media strategist that was originally from Sweden. I had studied abroad in Sweden, so we were chatting before the event. And so as we were watching it, you know, we had talked about being kind of design geeks and just the whole thing about what presentations looked best on that wall and what colors work and what colors don't work. So we were like black and white or the inverse of black and white, whichever, you know, go with one or the other. And some people had some like funky colors going, like green with pink on them. And it's like, if you have only a few slides, go with either simple or super cluttered, but make sure people can read the text or get, you know, you can get your message across. So it was just kind of, you know, it was kind of, again, you can have comedy just from that and meeting the people around you and kind of, you know, someone you just met kind of nudging each other about something you've talked about before the event started. They're awesome. So I hope that if anyone sees an event, an Ignite event, do anything you can to attend one because everybody needs to attend one, I think, in their life. That's my personal take anyway.
And Jennifer, you know, these are kind of community organized. Brady obviously doesn't do all of them. And we should have more in the Bay Area, so let's do that. Another idea I just want to throw out there while we're on the topic of Ignite is that, I've written about this a little bit recently, that we would love to encourage women in technology and in the web space to be more comfortable presenting at shows and putting themselves forward to present. And one idea there was to have an Ignite that's focused on just having female speakers. And not just in the Bay Area, but anybody who's interested in picking that up as a project in any city, we would encourage you to do it. Brady's obviously the guru on how you do an Ignite and has helped other people run them.
I'm happy to present, help organize, whatever. So if you want to talk offline later, I'm happy to help make that happen. But I have to ask you a couple questions that, you know, folks have been pressing me, you know, I have to ask them about, obviously there was a Web 3.0 conference this year. We only have a few minutes, but where does Web 2.0 go once, you know, it's almost 10 years, or maybe since the planning stage has been 10 years. What's after Web 2.0? Does it get a rebrand?
Well, let's see, Web 2.0 actually, the first Web 2.0 conference, which is where the term started, was 2004, so we're not quite there yet for 10. But we do think that an enormous amount has changed and grown since then, and that it is hard to summarize the current state of things with just that word. I think Web 3.0 is an unfortunate term because it misunderstands what Web 2.0 was in the beginning. It was really never intended to be a version number. It was supposed to alert the community to the fact that something was happening in the space that was very different from what had gone on before, and that there was a trend here that people needed to pay attention to if they were going to understand the business world on the web. But I personally don't see a common definition for Web 3.0 that makes sense to me, that's sort of coherent. What we've been talking about, and the place that I would point your listeners and you to sort of our best explanation of it that I've read, is a paper that John Battelle and Tim O'Reilly did a couple weeks ago, about a concept that we're calling Web Squared. And the idea of Web Squared is it works on two levels. One is like, okay, we're not just adding a two, but we're sort of elevating the two and saying it's really an exponential change. There's a lot of real concrete ways in which change has become exponential because of what the web and the ideas behind Web 2 in terms of user-generated content and platforms and data have caused data and opportunity to grow at an exponential level. But it's not just about that. It's about the way that Web 2 now isn't about just the web. It's about the industries that it is impacting. It's about the potential for it to grow in the world. It's about the ways that sensors now are contributing to collective intelligence to create much more robust platforms, much more robust senses of where we are and what we're doing. And a lot of that's what Brady was talking about with the geolocation platforms. But my best take on that really is explained, or I think the best take on that is explained very clearly and I think inspiringly, if I can coin a word, in the Web Squared paper that Tim and John wrote.
Well, we will definitely link to it. I have the white paper actually sitting on my desktop, so I will link to that from blogs.eastwick.com on the post about this podcast. Brady, we have about 2 minutes remaining. Any thoughts you want to share in addition to what Jen had said about what comes next after Web 2.0?
I think the most exciting area is going to be sensors and feedback, and geolocation is a big part of that. And bringing that data back into our lives and back into our applications for analysis is where the web is going to go to help people make decisions. Well, whether or not you want to call that Web Squared, Web 3.0, Web 2.0, that's where the web is going to be going, and that's where I think you'll see our events start to head in that direction.
And, of course, there's, you know, the obvious question about attendance to these events and that sort of thing. And I've saw, you know, at least for the tech web co-organized events, there's been a massive effort to bring prices down or create interesting packaging so that, you know, for $250 you can get a really good taste of a conference. So I think, you know, the questions around that, I mean, do you guys have any other thoughts on that? I think, you know, you're adapting as best you can, but the brands we're talking about here are big brands even on their own. So, you know, you mentioned decrease in attendance. Anything else that you're doing to try to increase, you know, make sure that all of these events get the fullest attendance possible?
We've always
had
a
great component. Well, one thing we've added.
Sorry.
We've added an online social network to the conference
to
help people make connections while there. Because it's never just about the speakers. I mean, one of the favorite things people like to say is, a conference is about who I'm going to skip sessions with. So people go there because they want to know what the speakers have to say, but they also go there because they know what type of person those speakers are going to attract.
Jen, quickly.
And it's really our job as conference organizers to make sure they can make those connections.
Okay, and Jen, quickly.
Yeah, exactly that. And we've from the very beginning, when the economy was much stronger, we've always wanted to have a free component. So you could always attend the keynotes and the Ignite and some of the other stuff for free. And that's the substrate that you need to start talking to people. You know, you want to talk about some kind of content. you want to have a reason to reach out to the guy in the hallway that you've just seen a great talk, and you want to get the other person's idea, that's you can do all that for free, and we're committed to that, whether the economy's strong or not.
Fantastic. I need to stop it there. Thank you so much for joining us. I could have spent hours talking with you, and I feel like we just really got started. Thank you to Brady Forrest and Jennifer Palka from Web 2.0 Expos, among the many other things we've talked about. As usual, you can go to blogs.eastlick.com, where I will link to or have linked to the many things that they've been involved in currently. And in the past, you can go through their bios and take a look at those. Next week, we will be talking with the leader of Salt Cellar Group, Regina Connell. That's 1 week from today at 12 noon Pacific. And I thank you for tuning in to Break Through the Noise. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.